Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the activist and writer Gloria Steinem. A world-renowned feminist, she has spent the past 45 years thinking, writing and talking about equality. Her logic's unimpeachable, her books are bestsellers, her lecture tours packed out. And yet, the movement she's championed still has a pretty long to-do list. Domestic violence, the pay gap, reproductive freedom. It would seem that even now, feminism continues to be a work in progress. Challenging convention isn't something she chose. Rather, it was part of her very beginnings. An itinerant childhood was spent travelling the highways and byways of America, following her father's restless, deep-seated desire to always move on. She was 12 before she completed a full year in school. She says, "I'm a realist, but I'm also a dreamer, and I'm not just a dreamer. I'm a hopeaholic." So welcome, Gloria Steinem. How much have your early 1970s hopes and dreams of what feminism could deliver for women come to fruition?
I think my dreams at that point were not big enough. You know, I think I was looking at equality, not transformation. And on the one hand, my dreams and ideas have become bigger, and therefore I think it's even more important than I did before, you know, to make a society in which the paradigm is the circle, not a pyramid, and we understand we are linked, we are not ranked. On the other hand, I realize what a huge victory it is just to know we're not crazy. Because in the beginning, just the idea of equal pay or, you know, the most basic things were considered to be crazy because they were thought to be dictated by biology.
How much is it a concern of yours that the people who put your books at the top of the New York Times bestseller lists or the people who pay to come and watch you lectures are pretty much people who kind of agree with you and think the same thing?
What you say, I think, is mitigated by hostility and curiosity. Both forces that drive people into big auditoriums and so on.
So you do get people who come along and challenge your
views? Yes, absolutely. And pickets and people who question and are mad. And also, but most importantly, I think people who are just curious.
You're very well known, of course, as a public speaker, but I've read you say that actually it's public listening that has taught you much in your life. Tell me more about that. What do you mean?
Well, I was a writer because I wanted to avoid speaking in public. And only when I couldn't get published what I thought was most exciting in the exploding women's movement did I end up going out with a friend who was fearless and becoming a speaker. In retrospect, I'm really, really grateful for that because otherwise I would never have discovered that something magic happens when you're all in a room together. People will stand up and say, in the force field of hundreds or even a couple thousand people, things they wouldn't say to their family or best friend. It's as if it makes an energy field.
Let's go to the music, Gloria Steinem. Tell me about your first disc of the morning then. What is it and why have you chosen it?
Well, Downtown, which I bet lots of people listening already know, Petula Clark. I must have worn out at least two, maybe three old-fashioned discs because it reminded me of my years of, say, 11 to 12 through 16 or 17, when Saturday was the day I could escape home, and home was kind of not always so great because my mother was not always able to take care of herself, so I was often her caretaker. And on Saturday afternoon, I could go meet a girlfriend at the movies and just completely lose myself. And this song, it just evokes that kind of longing for me.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown. When you've got worries, all the noise and the hurry seems to help, I know. Downtown, just listen to the music of the traffic in the city. Linger on the sidewalk where the neon signs are pretty. How can you lose? The lights are much brighter there. You can't forget all your troubles, forget all your cares, so go downtown.
That was Petula Clark and Downtown. So, Gloria Steinem, feminism then appears to be experiencing right now, I don't know if it's a third wave, I don't know if it's a fourth wave, but there's certainly a wave happening. Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely. There's a huge explosion of consciousness and activism.
Yeah, it wasn't there, right? 20 years ago when I was a young woman. What do you put it down to?
Well, it was always present. I think it's partly the web, you know, because you get all these ideas and information without the context of how old the person who said it was. You get each other's stories. There's a wave of activism against sexual assault on campus and the armed services. You know, there's just a lot of energy and hope.
Do you believe, I mean, that sort of contemporary activism, so much of which happens digitally online, which is known, I think, as clicktivism in some circles, you know, it's much easier, isn't it, to just click on a petition and say, I agree with that.
Well,
yeah, there I am. Do you think it matters?
That's not activism. Right. I mean, pressing send is not activism.
You know? Okay, so what is activism?
But it is the fuel for activism, because you're learning that other people feel the same as you do, that other people are experiencing the same injustice. And if you get together, you can change it.
How do you, and goodness knows you must have come up against it over the years, combat, and I'm talking just here about maybe in, you know, in social circumstances where you might be at a drinks party or sitting next to somebody at dinner who says, but you know, if you take all the differences away, Gloria, between the sexes, you take all the fun out of life.
Mm.
What do you say to that?
Well, I say, depending on how patient I am, that each of us is, in fact, a unique miracle of heredity and environment combined, millennia of heredity and environment combined in a way that could never have happened before and could never happen again. And we are all human beings. So to release the uniqueness is the important difference. To divide us into groups by race, by class, by gender, is false. We share, you know, 99% of everything as human beings. Why on earth would you put us in a box and give us a different label? It's a deprivation. Even if people are in the best box, it's still a deprivation.
Let's have some more music. Tell me about your second disc this morning. What are we going to hear next?
Well, you know, this Judy Collins' song, My Father, is about her own father, but it's also about my father. And my father was a dreamer, as was hers. And it made me sad for him because his dreams were not realized. He died alone. But on the other hand, I know the dream was what was important to him.
My father always promised her
was Judy Collins with My Father, indeed written for her father, but you were saying, Gloria Steinem, much of the lyric in that could have equally applied to your own
mm-hmm.
father. When I read about your early childhood, to be honest, I am perplexed as to how to sum it up. And so I'm going to ask you to sum it up.
Me
because
too.
It was so unusual. Can you describe it?
Well, I would say, first and most importantly, that my parents loved me and treated me better than they treated themselves. I mean, I knew they were doing the best they could. That meant that I was going with both parents and a house trailer and traveling.
And traveling would mean, I mean, your father had a small business which he had dreams of growing, which was a sort of little entertainment complex.
Yeah, he had a summer resort in southern Michigan on a freshwater lake. And one day it would get just too cold and he couldn't bear it anymore. So he would suddenly pile us all in the house trailer and the dog and, you know, five frying pans in one plate. I mean, we never quite got it right as we were leaving. And he had small antiques and jewelry that he would buy and sell to roadside dealers, and we stayed in trailer parks. And sometimes if we were flush, then we would stay in a motel so we could all have hot baths, and kind of worked our way to California or to Florida in the warm weather.
And your father had come from an upper middle-class Jewish background. Why did he want to live this life?
That's a good question. You know, I think his parents were immigrants who needed to create a secure life because they had not had it. And it was so secure that all I remember about it is a completely neat apartment and a ticking clock on the mantelpiece. And I think that it was just too secure and boring for my father.
How did you, for example, say, I don't know, learn to read if you weren't going to school? Were your parents educating you?
You know, first of all, there were lots of books in the house. They both, especially my mother, adored books. And she, as I discovered later, had been a very rare pioneering woman journalist quite a while before I was born. And I can remember taking a pencil and scribbling and saying, look, Mommy, I'm writing. I mean, I wasn't, you know, but I was already trying to read. And I learned to read from Heinz ketchup bottle labels, from billboards along the side of the road, and at nine, reading adult novels I had no business reading.
Let's have some more music, Gloria Steinem. Tell me about your third of the morning. What are we going to hear now?
Well, this is still while I'm a teenager and living with my mother by ourselves. My parents had separated. My father was living out of his car on the West Coast. We were in Toledo in Ohio. And the zoo, relatively near, had an outdoor amphitheater. And there were operettas in the summertime. And the singing chorus and the dancing chorus was hired locally. So at something like 13 or 14, I lied myself up to 18 because I was already very tall by that time, and danced in the chorus, you know, with occasional lions roaring and seals, you know, in the background. You know, it was quite wonderful summer outdoor entertainment. And Naughty Marietta was one of those, and I still remember a little bit of the steps.
Naughty Marietta, sung by Anna Moffo from Victor Herbert's operetta of the same name, with lyrics by Rita Johnson Young. You were saying during that, Gloria Steinem, that you have memories of, you know, the sort of baskets and the hooped skirts.
Yes,
and
yes,
the fake
little
flowers.
Carrying little baskets with phony flowers, running on tippy toe and then pointing it to. Right.
We're there.
Right.
Tell me more then about your mother. She had been, as you say, she was a newspaper reporter and then even a young editor at one point.
Yes, I believe she was Sunday editor before she left.
Remarkable. I mean, this would have been
amazing.
The 1920s.
In the 20s, or perhaps just over into 1930s. She had my sister by then, and my father, who was a wonderful human being, but perhaps the least financially responsible person. And my mother was always worried about money. So somehow it just became too much for her. She had had a miscarriage. She had fallen in love with a man in the newspaper office. And she didn't believe in divorce, so she didn't think she could leave. And for a whole bunch of reasons, she had what was then just called a nervous breakdown before I was born. And she was in a sanatorium for a year or two. I'm not sure how long.
And between the ages of 10 and 17, you were the sole carer for her. What are your strongest memories from that time?
Well, I think of her, and she was just always so vulnerable and sometimes off in another world talking to unseen voices. And, you know, sometimes when she was especially in another world, I would just sit there, you know, holding her hand because she thought there was a war outside and we were in danger, and I was afraid she would run out into the street. Sometimes, you know, she was okay. But I just never knew what I would find when I went home.
You once said, "I suspect, like many women, I'm living the unlived life of my mother."
It took me a while to understand that because I hadn't known about my mother's other life. And once I discovered it, and once I was no longer afraid of becoming my mother and understand her from safety, you know,
yeah,
I did begin to realize that I was living out her unlived life in many ways. And I don't say that with any resentment at all, because I'm living the life I love and I want. But I do think there are a lot of other people, women especially, but some men too, living out the unlived lives of their parents. And I hope profoundly that that diminishes. First of all, our parents should be able to live their own lives with their own talents. And secondly, we shouldn't have to feel guilty or driven, you know, to make up for their lives.
Gloria Steinem, let's have some more music then. Tell me, we're on your fourth of the day.
Well, this is from my college senior year. My mother was in the hospital. I was in college, so I was free. I had gone, in fact, to Geneva on my junior year. And through a girlfriend, utterly fell in love with a man who was 9 or 10 years my senior. I was just totally knocked out, you know, with this man, this family, everything. And they loved to play games. And their favorite game was that they would sing to each other, you know, 4 bars, 8 bars, and you had to guess what from. So this is the only thing that I ever recognized.
The Queen of the Night aria from Mozart's The Magic Flute, sung there by Karin Ott, with the Berlin Philharmonic conducted by Herbert von Karajan. Gloria Steinem, when did you become a feminist?
I mean, I always understood what I was experiencing was unfair. I just thought I had to get around it secretly somehow, you know. So it wasn't until the late 60s that I went to cover for New York Magazine, which I had helped to found. Because we had started it ourselves, I was able to have a political column for a change and write about what interested me. And for that column, I went to cover a hearing held in a church basement in downtown Manhattan that was an alternate hearing to one in our New York State legislature, where they were considering liberalizing the abortion law, and they had invited 14 men and one nun to testify. So you can't make this stuff up. So a group of young women said, no, wait a minute, let's hear from women who've actually had this experience. And they held a hearing. I went to cover it. And for the first time ever, I heard women standing up in public, taking seriously something that only happened to women, speaking out about it as they were not supposed to do. It was criminal, right? And demanding change. So it just upturned everything, because I had had an abortion here in London on my way to India, and I would not have been able to not marry the wrong man to whom I was engaged, a very nice man, but we weren't well suited to each other.
And so that was the end of the 50s that you were able to get an abortion as you traveled through London. And so as you heard those women stand up and say, this is how it is for me, was it a literal dawning?
Yes, it was. Because I just suddenly asked why. You know, I had not told anyone about my experience until then, which I think it's true of many women. And suddenly I heard these other women thanking doctors who had sometimes helped them, and also telling terrible stories of amateur abortions. I mean, everything was present in that room, you know, including women who had had to stand up before hospital boards and explain how they got pregnant. I mean, it was all there. It was all these experiences were there.
You will be aware as much as anybody, of course, that abortion generates very strong feelings, just the very discussion of it. When you started to write publicly about the subject of abortion, personally, what sort of response did you get from people?
Relief, really. I mean, because so many women and men who love women and care about women have experienced this, and it was a forbidden subject.
Let's have some more music, Gloria. Tell me what we're going to hear now. We are on to your fifth of the morning.
This is partly because it's my favorite voice, Phoebe Snow. Just a miraculous voice. And she was a friend. She's no longer with us. And her voice is a miracle, an absolute miracle, and I just want people to share it.
Phoebe Snow, Poetry Man. Gloria Steinem, it was 1972 when you and some fellow feminists decided that you would set up Ms. Magazine, which is still going. You said of the time those were heady and exciting and naive days. Tell me more about that.
Well, first of all, I kept saying, okay, I'm going to do this for 2 years, you know, because I imagined that if we could have a successful feminist magazine, that other women's magazines would change. I did not realize that, A, none of our other women's magazines are owned by women. B, they are supported by ads that dictate most of the copy. You know, in order to get ads for cosmetics, you have to have lots of beauty editorial and so on. I didn't realize how powerful the economic structure was.
So that was where the naivety came in. And I immediately wonder then, you know, as you say, women's magazines, they survive on advertising lipstick, or it could be handbags, or it could be cosmetic surgery, but basically all those ideals of femininity. Mm. And Ms. Magazine is a magazine that didn't and doesn't.
Yeah.
So how the heck has it funded itself?
The readers want it. Actually, we did better. I'm not saying that this is, you know, a hugely money-making operation. Small magazines are not, but it's self-supporting. And we started to do better economically when we stopped taking advertising. We could only get, you know, like wine and cars and things that didn't demand, because they were used to advertising to men, they didn't demand complimentary copy, you know, in the way that fashion and beauty does. And they set us free, editorially speaking. But it also was very difficult to get, because people didn't believe that women chose the car. They thought their fathers or their husbands or their boy. I don't know. So once we no longer had to have an ad staff and just went with no ads, we were better off economically. And I hope that we consider that when we look at the web, because I'm very worried that the web will be completely dominated by advertisers too. And I do believe that we as consumers will pay for what we want.
Time for some more music, Gloria Steinem. We are on your sixth disc of the day. Tell me about this.
Well, Stevie Wonder, Isn't She Lovely, is a wonderful song in itself because he's singing to his baby daughter. It's also very danceable, and it symbolizes to me all the songs of the 60s and 70s and 80s, and I love to dance, and this is a symbol of many, many, many danceable songs.
That was Stevie Wonder and Isn't She Lovely. Gloria Steinem, you have spoken today a couple of times to this awakening of the idea as a young woman, and a woman in her early 30s, that actually you could choose the life that you wanted to live for yourself, that really that's what feminism is. Mm. You don't have children. Was that a decision that you made, or was that just how life ended up being for you?
Well, I think I thought everyone had children, and was I thought you were crazy if you didn't. And it was the advent of feminism and reading and an understanding that you could live in different ways that made me realize I was happy. So although I occasionally thought that I might adopt a child, every time I imagined it, I imagined that I would come upon an 8 or 9 or 10 or 11-year-old little girl who needed help, and I would adopt her. And finally, even I, who am not very introspective, had to realize that it was about adopting myself, you know, because that's the age at which I was probably in the most trouble. And there are all kinds of ways that we have children in our lives. I mean, my sister had 6 children. They have children. My friends have children. But I just felt no need. You know, someone once said, there's no more reason for everybody with a womb to have a child than for everyone with vocal cords to be an opera singer. It's a gift.
You very famously once said, of course, to a journalist who was interviewing you, who said, you look great for 40, and you said, this is what 40 looks like. What does 81 feel like?
Quite amazing. I mean, I practically stop people in the street to tell them how old I am because I'm trying to make myself realize it. It seems like someone else's age.
Okay.
Right. And all the more so, I mean, I'm about to be 82, so I'm the age my mother was when she died. And by that time, she had been in a nursing home for several years. You know, I mean,
yes.
I forget it, you know, for a while, and then somebody reminds me. It does seem odd, but I am determined to realize it in a deep sense so that I make good use of my time. I mean, I plan to live to 100, mind you,
yes.
But even so, that's not a very long time.
It's time now for your 7th disc, Gloria. Tell me about this. What are we going to hear?
Somehow, Vivaldi's 4 Seasons, I don't know why, but I figure if I'm listening to Vivaldi's 4 Seasons, nothing too bad can happen.
That was the Allegro from Winter, part of Vivaldi's Four Seasons, played by the New York Philharmonic there, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. Gloria Steinem, you got married in the year 2000, and that surprised a lot of people. Did you surprise yourself with that one?
Absolutely. Right. Yes, I mean, we loved each other. We wanted to be together. But we wouldn't have thought about getting legally married at that point, except that he had been born in South Africa. He had a British passport. And the kind of visa that he had been eliminated by Congress, I'm sorry to say. And so I thought about it, and I thought, well, you know, we've just spent 30 years trying to make the marriage laws equal. No longer was I going to lose my name, my credit rating, my legal domicile, you know, by getting married. And I called up my friend, Wilma Mankiller, who was the chief of the Cherokee Nation. And I said, what do you think? You know, I'm thinking about getting married. So she said, well, I'll call you in the morning. So she went out and sat under the stars for an hour or so and decided, yes, okay. So we had a Cherokee ceremony.
You were married for only 3 years when your husband was diagnosed with a brain lymphoma. And you've said that he taught you about dying. That's such an interesting phrase. Can you explain a wee bit of that to me?
I think, first of all, he taught me to live in the present. He was an intensely living in the present person. And I lived in the future, perhaps left over from trying to escape from my childhood. And also, in some ways, he allowed me to live the experience with my mother in a good way. Because by then, I was a grown-up, and I could take care of another grown-up, you know? So I never understood when people said about very painful things, it was meant to be, or I wouldn't change it. But I kind of feel that way somehow. Yes, I would have changed it, but as it was, I think it was important to both of us.
Before we listen to your last piece of music, I want to ask you, you're aware that I'm going to cast you away to a desert island today. You'll be all on your own. How are you? Are you a practical person? Can you fish? Could you gut an animal? Could you build a shelter?
Probably, but only out of extreme necessity.
So that's a yes, then. Let's hear your final piece of music, then, Gloria Steinem. What are we going to listen to now as your eight?
Well, this is also because of who it is, Jessie Norman. I mean, she was a little girl, an African-American girl in the American South, but she happened to be able to listen to opera on the radio. And so her imagination soared. She's a miracle of human possibility, and you hear it in her voice.
That was Jessie Norman singing When I Am Laid in Earth from Purcell's Dido and Aeneas. The music was played by the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Raymond Leppard. It's time now for me to give you, Gloria, the books. We give every castaway the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare to take to this island, and they get to take one other book too. What's your other book going to be?
Do I have to take the Bible?
No, you certainly don't.
You know, I think that I would take The Color Purple because it's a great novel and it's about survival, which I would need on a desert island. Alice Walker is a dear friend, so I could imagine she was there with me.
We shall give you that then. Everybody is allowed a luxury, too.
Well, I do think, I mean, unless there's a large supply of coconut oil there, that something, you know, either eye drops or moisturizer. Presumably there's water to drink or I wouldn't be alive.
I think there's a good chance you find a source of fresh water. I think the eye drops, because I think there might be a coconut or two.
All right, I'll go for the eye drops.
Okay, they're yours then. And if the waves were to threaten to wash away the discs, which one would you run to save
I guess I would choose Jesse Norman's voice because it would be a chance for both music and a friend.
It's yours. Gloria Steinem, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.